Very quickly recap where we've got to. The preacher has spent the first three chapters exposing us, really, hasn't he? He's begun with by telling us life is short. He's told us that life is not something that can be kind of grasped and held onto or used to produce some kind of gain or profit. And his bottom line in that, although he shows it in lots of different ways, his bottom line in that is we can't do it because ultimately death comes to all. He basically says, look, your life is on loan and one day it will be recalled. He's also told us that we live wanting to control life. Particularly, we often want to control the elements of life that are uncontrollable. We'd like to be able to make sure that what happens tomorrow is what we want to happen tomorrow, and what happens next week is what we want to happen next week. And the reality is, we just can't do it. He's also told us that we like to change things. Often, again, the things that can't be changed, things that we don't have the power to change. And again, the bottom line in that really is what he's saying is we want to be God. We want to be God. We want to do his job. But the reality is we aren't. There is a big difference between the creator and us, the creature. And basically he says the sooner we realize that, the better. The sooner we realize who we are, what we are, and what that looks like in life in general, the better. But he also says if we're not willing to acknowledge that, we will find that life is a chasing after the wind. That we are literally running down the street trying to catch the wind. And we can't do it. Now at first we might have thought, well, the preacher's just been really, really depressing here. This is all very negative. It's all very much a downer. Do we really have to keep reading through the rest of Ecclesiastes? But actually, he has pointed us to hope, hasn't he? He hasn't left us completely hopeless. He has pointed us to the way forward. He particularly hinted that in the end of chapter 2, gave us a pointer towards it. And we find right at the end that this is the ultimate conclusion. But he's basically said we need to fear God. We need to stand in awe of God as creatures, in awe of the Creator. He's also told us that we need to obey him and enjoy him. And particularly when thinking about life and all that it brings, enjoying it for what it is, rather than trying to use it and manipulate it to get something else. He's saying, look, it's given as a gift. Use it as a gift. Enjoy it as a gift. Be content with what you've been given. And then in chapter 4, we get to another point that the preacher wants to direct us to. He basically says, look, living for us is better than living for me. He expects us to agree with the idea that the person that each of us most thinks about is ourselves. The person that each of us most thinks about is ourselves. Who occupies our mind the most? Ourselves. Think about what we're going to do, how we're going to manage things. What am I going to do? What am I going to get out of today? What am I going to do tomorrow? What am I going to, et cetera, et cetera. He wants us to see, though, that living for other people and thinking most about them, how we can help them, how we can serve them, will actually make us happier people. That's where he's going to get to. But he opens with a brutal reality in verses 1 to 3. He basically says, look, there is loads of oppression in the world. There are oppressors who are powerful and the oppressed who cry out in tears. And the devastating icing on the heartbreaking cake is the repeated line that those who are oppressed have no one to comfort them, nobody to wipe away their tears, nobody to help them. Now, let me say right at the start that I'm well aware that sat even in front of me, as well as watching online, are people in our congregation and maybe others who have tuned in who have suffered some horrendous things at the hands of others, who know this feeling of oppression, being oppressed, crying out, and have nobody to comfort them. Some have been oppressed by people in authority over them. Some have been abused by people close to them who they should have been able to trust. And so they've lived through this reality. They've not just observed it from a distance like the preacher does here. They've felt the agony of having no one to comfort them. And so let me just say, if that is the case, if that describes you, and particularly if it describes you and you've never talked to anybody about it, then let me gently encourage you to do that. Talk to somebody who you know and who you can trust. Now, the scenes the preacher has witnessed, all of these oppressions that he has seen around him, leads him to two stunning statements in verses 2 and 3. First of all, he says, better are the people who are already dead. Better off are the people who are already dead than those who are still alive. And second, even better than the people who have lived but are already dead are those who have never been born. Those have not existed yet. Basically, he says, look, the evil that I have witnessed around the world is so horrific, so gut-wrenching, so devastating, that it would have been better to have never have seen it and never have known it existed. Now, that probably feels, again, like a very depressing opening to a chapter and to a sermon. You might say, oh, it just feels a bit too dark. But I don't think the preacher's being a pessimist here at all. I think he's just telling us what the world is like. Think about the cases of oppression and abuse that make it onto the news. Now, I'm not going to give details of all these things out for obvious reasons. Think about the famous cases. Victoria Climby, abused by a great aunt and her boyfriend. Hundreds of injuries, died of hypothermia. Baby P, who for many years wasn't named because of the case that was ongoing. 17 months old, over 50 injuries in the course of 8 months. Harold Shipman, killed 15 patients and was convicted of killing 15 patients, but it was believed that up to 250 may have died at his hands. Think about the case posthumously against Jimmy Savile. Or the news this week of a young man called Keon Lincoln, who was 15 years old and was brutally murdered in broad daylight on a residential street in Birmingham. Think about a national scale. Think about the camps that have been exposed in China, where the Uyghur people are being basically condensed into one area and brutally oppressed by the government. Think about all the people who are displaced as refugees in places like Sudan and Syria. They might not be on the news today, but those things haven't magically disappeared. They're still happening. And those things, we can't unsee them, can we? We can't unhear them. And we can't dwell on them for a long time because the weight of them feels unbearable. Think about comic relief as a night on television. Why is it that the horrendous images, the heartbreaking images, are broken up by light-hearted comedy? Because we can't hack just seeing those images on repeat without something to distract us in between. It's why we turn off the news when those brutal details of some of those cases that I mentioned come on, and we flick to another channel where there's something mindless that can just wash over us, because the reality is we can only take so much oppression. We can only handle seeing so much evil and so much abuse. And so we cope with it by distracting ourselves away from it. That's what the preacher is saying here. And I think if we've never felt what the preacher feels, then maybe we've sheltered ourselves from reality too much. Maybe we've actually ignored the truth and just tried to pretend that it doesn't happen. Or maybe we're sat there thinking, well, what am I supposed to do about this? How am I supposed to to talk to somebody who's faced this if I haven't? Well, sometimes the reality is actually there isn't really anything we can say particularly to them. Sometimes there isn't anything we can particularly do. Sometimes we have to say we don't know why this is happening, even though we see it happening. Sometimes, as Christians in particular, the thing we can do is we can pray, particularly for things that are in a distance away from us. But as Christians, there is something different there. The whole thing isn't completely hopeless. There is a hope that shines through, a light that shines into that darkness. Now, we have to be very careful not to speak of that hope in a very trite way. We have to make sure we don't speak of that hope in a way that plays down the seriousness and the horror of some of the things that people have faced. But there is a hope that comes from Jesus. See, when Jesus came into this world, he encountered the brokenness and the oppression that the preacher speaks about. He groaned and he sighed and he was indignant at the results of sin. If you read through the Gospels, you find that on a number of occasions. He came into his good world that had been spoiled. And wonderfully, his response wasn't to go on a rampage and condemn immediately. It wasn't to be passive and unmoved and withdrawn from it, but it was to be compassionate, to show compassion to those who were affected by it. He helped the vulnerable and the needy and the outcast, and he healed people, and he showed people that there could be restoration, there could be transformation, even in this broken world. And then ultimately he went to the cross to show not only the seriousness of sin, the seriousness of the evil and the brokenness that was all around, but to show too that there was then an offer of forgiveness. And through all that he experienced, he actually experienced oppression and abuse. And he was beaten and he was mocked. And he was abandoned and he was rejected. And so as we look at Jesus, the other thing that we can see, particularly if we are someone who has faced these things personally, is that Jesus feels your pain. And then in his resurrection from the dead, he gave the hope of something beautiful beyond this life. He gave the hope that there is a restoration, a complete restoration to come. When he returns, all of the injustice and all of the oppression in the world will once and for all be finally dealt with. And so we can look forward with hope to that day, sure that he will return and make all things new. And so the first thing the preacher points us towards is that there is oppression everywhere. There is trampling over the weak by the strong. There is the powerful abusing the vulnerable. The Bible is unashamed to speak about that reality too. It doesn't hide it away somewhere. It's not like the preacher's the only person to say that. It comes in loads of forms in Scripture. Comes when there are rules against stealing and speaking about abuse of position or authority. The Bible warns strongly against unjust gain and against denial of rights and denial of justice. But the Bible also speaks about those things being at root about profit and gain without regard for others. In other words, oppression like this flows from selfishness. And if you look at verse 4, this is where the hammer blow brings to all of us the reality that oppression isn't just something out there, but something that resides in here, in our hearts. Look what he says. I saw that all toil and achievement spring from one person's envy of another. In other words, putting it straight after this description of oppression that goes on in the world, the preacher says the problems stem from selfish hearts, stem from our envy of our neighbour. In other words, the endless rat race, the wanting more, the keeping up with the Joneses. The fact is, because it becomes from the fact that we think somebody else somewhere is gaining more from life than we are, and we don't like it. Maybe we look at what other people our age are earning. We look at what other people in our stage in life have achieved. We look up our school friends on Facebook and we compare our lives to them. Maybe we read what other churches are doing on Twitter and we assess whether we're flying or falling. If we're not matching up, then we take steps to change that, usually meaning that we work harder or we work more or we get others to work harder for us and we cut time with the people we love in the name of giving them something better when reality what we want is to feel better about ourselves. And you can apply this beyond money and achievement here. We could look at terms of gaining in terms of our own image and in terms of our identity in general. We want others to look at us and think we are successful. We want to be the envy of other people rather than us envying them. But again, the preacher says, look, these things will never satisfy. Chasing them will only have a negative effect on other people. You might say, well, how? Well, the bottom line is, by simply being self-centered, which all of these things are at root, we aren't looking out for and loving our neighbour. We're looking out for and loving me at the expense of neighbour. Putting this here in verse 4, straight after that observation of oppression in the world, the preacher is saying, look, and this is the words of a commentator called Ian Provan. He says, in pursuing out of envy the neighbour above us on the ladder, we inevitably step on the head of the neighbour below us on the ladder. So in striving to reach the next level because somebody else has got there before us, we reach up to grasp at them, and in to do that, we put our foot on the head of the one below us. Oppression, as I said, isn't something that's just out there done by certain people in certain places with certain positions of power or in business or in government or in kind of fame and popularity. It's not just something that people out there are guilty of, but we are in the same boat because as human beings we are selfish to the core. And if we're honest with ourselves, we justify to ourselves all kinds of things in order to get what we want. We'd never put it like this, but the reality is that other people can be crushed as long as I get to be king. And he says, look, it's all pointless. It's all for nothing. It's all a chasing after the wind, verse 4. Because not only do we end up treating other people like dirt, which is the worst part of it, we get nothing from it either. Because there's no satisfaction there. You get to the person above you on the ladder, oh, there's still somebody else above. It's a never-ending ladder. It goes on forever. The thing we've reached for, wanted, sought to grasp hold of, just won't last and won't satisfy. That's also what it says at the end of verse 6. Two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. Now, if anybody thinks, well, okay, so what's the preacher saying? I just shouldn't try at anything. I should just be lazy. I should just sit back and do nothing. Well, no, because in verse 5, he says, fools fold their hands and ruin themselves. The fool does nothing and gets nothing. Or literally, apparently, and I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but I looked this up. Apparently, verse 5 literally says he embraces his hands and eats his own flesh. It's a pretty vivid picture, isn't it? The fool who does nothing is definitely no better off than the person who chases and grasps after everything. They're both left with nothing, no satisfaction. The reality is some people will get to the end of their lives wishing they'd spent less time in the office. And some people will get to the end of their lives wishing they'd spent at least some time in the office. The answer is somewhere in the middle. Look at verse 6. The person who has one handful with tranquility. The person who has one handful with tranquility. In other words, there'll be a person who has one handful, who's working hard, receiving as a gift, doing what God has called them to do, and they will find some balance, some satisfaction, some peace, some fulfillment. It is a picture of contentment. It is a picture of happiness. They're happy to accept what has been given. They're enjoying life one day at a time. They're not striving after something they can't get hold of, and they're not sitting back doing nothing. Now in verse 7 and 8, the preacher then again fleshes out what happens to the person whose life is all about work and wealth. What does he have, or what does she have? It's not limited to men. What do they have? Nothing. No one. No family, no friends. They are consumed with wanting and having more. They work so much to try and get more that they never stop. They never ask the question, what am I doing all this for? What am I missing out on? They're so consumed. And if they do ask that question, they think, oh, well, I'll do it tomorrow. Today I'll just get more. There'll always be tomorrow. The person who does that, the person described in verses 7 to 8, hasn't come to the realization that rest and peace are more important than wealth and success. I mean, as you read verse 7 and 8, right, you can see that all around the world, right? How many marriages have been ruined by the lie that working more will mean more stuff, more contentment, and a happy retirement? And in reality, the relationships within that are ruined. How many kids have grown up without a mom or a dad being around, or whose time is so limited with them that they might as well not be there? They get stuff from their parents, but they get nothing of their parents. How many people work every hour under the sun and therefore don't eat well, don't sleep well, and have health problems? How many wealthy people end up being miserable people, all alone? They have all the parties, and that's what gets shown on the news, and it looks so wonderful and so great. They have so many so-called friends. But when the music stops, they've got nobody to laugh with and nobody to cry with. That's the picture he's giving here. And so the preacher is saying, look, underwork and overwork are both a failure to understand God's rest and God's grace and God's provision. I was struck again, just in case you think I'm pointing outwards to everybody else and this has nothing to do with me. I was struck again by a passage in a commentary I was reading that applied this particularly to ministry. And the reality for the minister is, the minister can begin to feel that they are indispensable to God's plans. That's why ministers often overwork. Well, if I don't do that, who else is going to do it? If I don't meet every need in the congregation, who's going to do it? If I'm not available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, well, what happens if something happens and it goes all wrong? Well, that'd be my fault. And the minister can very easily begin to think he needs to meet everybody's needs rather than pointing people to Jesus. There is a real danger as well of the minister thinking, right, well, I need to work every hour that is sent under the sun. I need to do everything that is possible within my power so that I can leave a legacy. And so the reality for me is, I need to remember the quote I gave on week one. Remember the guy with a brilliant name, Nicholas von Zinzendorf? What did he say? Preach the gospel, die, be forgotten. Preach the gospel, die, and be forgotten. Anything else? Doesn't really matter. Now I'd say, okay, well, again, Matt, this is still very depressing. All it's done is tell us what's wrong with us and what's wrong with the world. What are we supposed to do with it? Look at verses 9 to 12. There's a better way to work and a better way to live. Basically, verses 9 to 12 tell us two are better than one. So the preacher has already said to us, hasn't he, that life is about enjoying God and enjoying his good gifts, enjoying the season that we're in, enjoying the time that we're in, rather than wishing them all away. And now the added factor, he says, is, well, don't do it alone. Don't do it alone. Someone to share the workload and the fruits of that workload with is good. Someone to lift you up when you fall and walk alongside you to keep you going is good. Someone to keep warm with, he says. And if you've ever slept in a tent on your own, you'll know how much nicer it is just to have another body in there with you. This makes a big difference. He says someone to face opposition with when trouble comes. Someone to stand with you so you're not overpowered. And the progression of these pictures that he gives are of basically a journey, aren't they? A journey with trials on the way. And every single situation is handled and dealt with better if you're not alone. Now somebody might turn around and say, yeah, but the person who's on their own can move quicker. They're not weighed down by somebody else and maybe doesn't walk as quick. Yeah, but what happens if they fall? What happens if they get attacked? See what the preacher is saying? You might get there faster on your own, but every obstacle on the way, not so good. Much better with somebody else. He even then says, look, three is better than two. And I guess you could argue maybe four is better than three, but we'll not go there. Now you might look at that last verse and say, yeah, but isn't that last verse, a cord of three strands is not quickly broken, about marriage with Jesus at the centre? Well, that is true. Marriage with Jesus at the centre is a strong thing. But I don't think that's what the preacher's got in mind here. I don't think that's what this verse is about. It'd be very strange if that was the main application of this verse, wouldn't it, in the rest of this chapter? The main thrust of this section, of this positive section, is that life is better in community. Which shouldn't be surprising to us if we know our Bibles well, because we were created to live in community. We were made in the image of God, and one of those ways that we were made in the image of God is that we were made for relationship. And so the picture so far is that life striving to get ahead is fundamentally selfish and anti-neighbour, and so the answer is to be pro-neighbour. Hence the reason we read those two commands at the beginning. What are the two greatest commands, Jesus says? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul and strength. That's the idea of fearing God and obeying his commandments that the preacher has already brought out. And what was the second? Love your neighbour as yourself. In other words, the antidote to this striving after and chasing after the wind is actually to love your neighbour. Instead of loneliness and futility that causes pain and misery for others, the preacher is saying, no, look out for other people. Shift the focus away from living for me to living for us. In many senses, Paul's words to Timothy about the love of money being a root of all kinds of evil, the preacher uses the same kind of picture in the sense of grasping for all you can with two hands is the root of all kinds of evil. And so the answer is a life lived in partnership and community. It is better for you and it is better for the ones you live with. You enjoy what you've got for what it is. Like I say, it's a life of complete shift in focus from me to we and from I to others. And so if we struggle with some of the things that are mentioned in here, if we struggle with laziness, the question is, well, think about how you can use your time and skills to help others. And think about who is having to work and what they are having to do because you're not willing to do it. You see, the outward focus on the neighbour, on the other, will help us to transform the way we think and live. If we struggle with wanting more money or more stuff or more status, then a sure and certain way to counteract that is to give it away. To be generous frequently. And then we will find that Jesus' words are also true, that it is more blessed to give than to receive. The next pay rise we get, think about how much more we can give or what new project we can support rather than the number of cool things that we're able now to buy. See the shift there. It's a shift from selfishness to loving neighbour. And I look at the last section, verses 13 to 16, and say, well, what's this got to do with it? It feels a little bit different to the rest. Now, apparently the Hebrew is really difficult to translate. But the story seems to be about there is a poor but wise young man who comes to the throne, but who gets there and forgets his origins and becomes an old stubborn man who won't listen to anybody else, who lives in a world of his own. And it was funny, as I read this, a song came to mind, and most of you will not have a clue what this song is, but some of you will, so you'll laugh. There was a song written by and sung by Jennifer Lopez, who sang this. "Don't be fooled by the rocks that I've got. I'm still Jenny from the block. I used to have a little, now I have a lot. No matter where I go, I know where I came from." So I had this song, Jenny from the Block, running around my head all week, which was a bit of a pain in the neck. But the point being that she's become this famous person, and people were saying, oh, she's forgotten her roots, whatever else. And she said, no, I haven't forgotten my roots. I might now be famous. I might have all these things. But really, I'm still Jenny from around the corner. I know where I came from. Even though I've got loads of stuff, I know where my roots were. And the picture of this king here is actually he forgot where he came from. He was young. He was poor. He may well have been in prison. And he came to the kingship. But when he got to the kingship, he basically became arrogant, didn't want to listen to anybody, and became a bit of a fool. And then he was replaced by another young man. But that king, that kingship wasn't great for him either, we're told. He felt the burden of his role as the king and all the people he was responsible for, and it was hard work. And the hard work wasn't appreciated. Those who came later were not pleased with the successor. And they didn't remember him when he was gone either. At the end of this, the preacher is basically saying, even the king hasn't got it all. Even the king hasn't got everything that what you're thinking you need to live for and strive for. He hasn't got it all either. And again, to quote Ian Provan, he says, "All in all, kingship is a thankless task. It's toil and trouble on the one hand and lack of appreciation on the other." We have this idea that if we get everything we want, that basically if we're king of our own little worlds, everything will be great. And at the end of the chapter, the preacher says it's not. It's not. So whether it's wealth or status or power that we're tempted to live for, it isn't going to give us what we think it will give us. It's not going to give us what we want. The preacher is again telling us to enjoy life as a gift. And again, to quote somebody else, this is not a phrase I came up with, but it's a helpful one. We might not have as much as we would like, but we all have more than we deserve. And the preacher says to us, look, enjoy this life. Enjoy this life that is given as a gift. And live it with others, he says. Rather than living for gain for yourself, seek to love and serve and bless other people. And so if we've grasped that we need to fear God, and if we've grasped that we need to see life as a gift and stop chasing after it for something it's not meant to be, the next question we've got to say is, well, who can we serve? Who can we help? Who can we work with? Who can we walk through life with? Who can we give to? And so the reality is, chapter 4 of Ecclesiastes points us to a big truth that is all over Scripture. Loving God and loving neighbour is not just what God requires from us, but it's also what is best for us.